LRS and Will Acheson do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation.
Welcome to LRIS's First Thursday podcast. I'm Will Acheson, and we'll be covering what's happened over the course of the last 30 days in public safety labor relations. Let's start off with a couple of big city bargaining issues. And first of all, let's start in Chicago, where we've had a pretty interesting development. In Chicago, over in the police department, there are multiple labor organizations. One of them, the FOP, represents the rank and file police officers in the city. However, there's also a sergeant's bargaining unit. The rank and file unit has been in fairly contentious negotiations with the city of Chicago. In particular, there have been public statements made by the mayor and by the FOP, and it has looked, at least from afar, like there's going to be a very long road to either a successfully negotiated contract or perhaps binding arbitration. What has come as a surprise is that there is a tentative settlement in the contract with the sergeants. This is not a small bargaining unit. There's 1,125 sergeants in this bargaining unit. The big issue in the bargaining, believe it or not, was not wages, it was pensions. And there was a complicated pension settlement. And the way that this pension settlement will work is that the amount that sergeants contribute to their pension will increase by 1% per year up until a total contribution per sergeant on January 1, 2015 of 12%. In the meantime, if the pension fund recovers its funding status, if it gets to the point where the pension is 80% funded, then employee contributions would be reduced to 10% a year. The deal on pension also includes a give back with respect to the cost of living increases for retirees in the even numbered years covered by the contract, 2014, 2016, and 2018, the cost of living raises would be forfeited. In the odd-numbered years of the contract, 2015, 2017, and 2019, there would be a 2.5% cost of living escalator based on simple interest. There are some other aspects to the settlement that are significant. First of all, there is a wage settlement that will call for a 9% raise spread over 4 years. There's going to be no change to the $1,800 annual uniform allowance and no change to a feature of the Chicago Sergeant's contract called availability pay, which amounts to $3,220 a year that supplements a sergeant's income. It will be interesting now to watch whether or not the rank and file bargaining unit will start talking in terms of a settlement much along the lines of what the sergeants did. This is a fairly classic negotiations tactic where an employer will attempt to reach a settlement with a smaller union in the hopes of leveraging that settlement out to covering a larger union. But Chicago labor relations follow anything but the usual pattern. This one will be one we should keep our eyes on fairly closely. A second labor issue that I want to talk about is actually a place where there is no contract, and that's Washington, D.C. And in fact, police officers and firefighters in Washington, D.C. have been without a contract since 2007, 6 years without a contract. The thing that has happened in the last month that is interesting is there has been fairly widespread political support for raises for police officers and firefighters. The mayor of Washington, D.C., Vincent Gray, threw his support behind raises. He held a press conference, and his comments were widely reported. Also, the police chief, Kathy Lanier, also indicated that she supported wage raises, and she was talking just about the FOP. The latter comments by Chief Lanier are pretty interesting because there is a very, very difficult relationship between the rank and file bargaining unit in the DC police, which is represented by the Fraternal Order of Police, and Chief Lanier. Chief Lanier is coming off of a five-year contract that covered all of this period that DC police did not have a raise. And in that five-year contract, she received $75,000 in raises. She's a comparatively well-paid police chief. Her salary is $253,817 a year. There have been many, many public comments attacking Chief Lanier made by the head of the FOP's negotiating arm, Officer Christopher Bauman, and attacking her both for decisions she's made from an operational standpoint and also from the standpoint of comments basically indicating that amount of a raise, a $75,000 raise over the course of 5 years when rank and file officers are receiving nothing, is, in Officer Bauman's words, not the kind of leadership he would expect to see. But at any rate, now there at least is some political support for raises. Nobody knows how much, and the negotiations are secret under Washington, D.C. law, and nobody knows when, but this is the first time there's been some sort of movement in that direction in a long, long time. Let's shift gears now and talk a little bit about the Family and Medical Leave Act, because we have some developments under the FMLA that are pretty interesting. I mentioned last month that the Department of Labor had issued a guidance, an interpretation on the FMLA, which you can find on the Department of Labor's webpage. It's interpretation number 2013-01, had issued a guidance in which it gave the opinion, really, I think for the first time clearly, that the phrase child for purposes of FMLA leave, you're allowed to use FMLA leave if your child has a serious health condition, that word child includes children of any age. There had been some thought, good deal of thought, that in order to be a child, you had to be under the age of majority, or at least that your serious health condition had to have been incurred before you reach the age of majority. The Department of Labor's new guidance rejects all that and says that so long as the person is a child and meets the ADA's definition of having a disability and the employee is needed to provide care for the child, then FMLA leave may be appropriate. That was last month's development. This month's development is that the Department of Labor has released new certification forms for FMLA leave. And this actually is a big deal, kind of a subtle big deal. Under the Family and Medical Leave Act, if an employer requests it, the employee has to produce what's called medical certification of a serious health condition, whether it's the employee's serious health condition or whether it's the health condition of the member of the immediate family for whom the FMLA leave is being taken. Certification can be on any form, but the Department of Labor has had forms that have been used for many years. What it has done is to revise those forms, and you can find these on the Department of Labor's webpage as well. What is so fascinating about these forms when you look through them is that you'll see a section 3 it's called, that's for completion by the healthcare provider. And you can read through there and read through there in vain for any requirement that the healthcare provider identify what the serious health condition is of the employee. There is a section of the form that indicates or gives the option to the healthcare provider to provide what are called other relevant medical facts. But apart from that optional area, what the healthcare provider is required to put down doesn't indicate what the nature of the condition is. Instead, they are generic questions. The approximate date the condition commenced, the probable duration of the condition, the dates for treatment, and whether medication was provided, all of those sorts of things. This development, I think, goes hand in hand with what we've seen over in the Americans with Disabilities Act front, where we have seen courts and the Department of Labor taking the position pretty strongly that routine doctor's notes from that are necessary in order to justify the use of sick leave may well violate the medical privacy provisions of the ADA. And it looks like the Department of Labor is picking up that theme over on the FMLA front. Let's move on over now to the arbitration front, where we've got a couple of issues that have come up that I think are worthy of comment. The first one is the continuing debate around the country about reinstatements of police officers who have been terminated for untruthfulness. And I need to set the stage a little bit on this. These cases involve challenges to arbitrator decisions, court challenges usually to arbitrator decisions, sometimes they're labor board challenges. And the challenges are typically all for the same reason, and that is that the reinstatement of a police officer who has been found to be dishonest violates public policy. And that there is an exception to the general rule that arbitration decisions are final and binding. There is an exception if the arbitrator's decision would require the employer to do something that violates public policy. What we've had happen in the last month is a case out of Connecticut where we see a court not following the general trend. So what's the general trend and what did this court in Connecticut do? The general trend, and I think the general trend is best exemplified by a decision from 2009 out of the Washington Supreme Court, a case involving Kitsap County. The general trend is for courts to look at an arbitrator's opinion in a truthfulness case and engage in a search for what public policy demands. And it's really a two-part search, not a one-part search. The first part of the search is there a public policy against police officers being untruthful? I don't know of a court that has a problem answering that question. Yes, there's a public policy against police officers being untruthful. You can find that public policy in any number of state statutes, particularly those governing certification of law enforcement officers. You can also find that public policy, I think, inherent in the developments under the Brady Rule. So I've never seen a court that really has a problem with this notion that there's a public policy against an officer being untruthful. The second question, though, that the courts asked is there a public policy against the reinstatement of an officer who has been untruthful? And there, courts find it hard to identify a public policy prohibiting reinstatement. Instead, what courts say is, look, there are all sorts of public policies where we consider mitigating circumstances when we're looking at disciplinary offenses, and those public policies don't draw the line at untruthfulness cases. And it is possible, say these courts, for officers who've been found guilty of untruthfulness to rehabilitate themselves. Or perhaps it is the case that they were untruthful in connection with a very stressful time of their lives, or perhaps they were under the influence of alcohol or some such thing, and this is not emblematic of a a lifelong problem with untruthfulness. In other words, it's possible that you can have an employee, a police officer, who can be rehabilitated even though they have been untruthful. That's what the Washington Supreme Court found in that Kitsap County case dealing with a deputy sheriff who had been terminated for being untruthful, reinstated by an arbitrator. The court said, yeah, public policy against officers being untruthful, but there's no public policy that commands that an officer who has been untruthful be fired. And there are jobs, Kitsap County, that you can find for this deputy, even if there might be a Brady problem for a while with that deputy testifying in court. So that's the general rule, and that's the rule that we see followed in state after state. It's also followed at the federal level. The Connecticut courts, though, seem to march to a bit of a different drummer when considering appeals of arbitration decisions. It's probably easier for an employer or a labor union to appeal an arbitrator's decision in Connecticut than it is in any other state in the country. This is a case involving the town of Stratford, Connecticut, and it fired a police officer for being untruthful during a fitness for duty evaluation. The case went to arbitration, and the arbitration panel ordered the officer reinstated without back pay, but without loss of seniority. And the arbitration panel found that the officer had been untruthful, but found that there were mitigating circumstances that justified a penalty other than termination. The Connecticut Court of Appeals overturned the arbitrator's opinion and found that it violated public policy. And I'm going to read to you a couple of sentences from the court's opinion so you can get the tenor of where the court was coming from. The court reasoned that the town claims that there's a well-defined public policy in Connecticut against officers intentionally lying in connection with their employment. And parenthetically, the town pointed to, among other things, the Brady rule. The court went on to say that our Supreme Court has held that evidence of a witness having previously lied is exculpatory material falling within the Brady disclosure requirements. We agree with the town that these authorities plainly demonstrate a clear public policy in Connecticut in favor of honest police officers and consequently against lying by police officers in connection with their employment. The arbitration award reinstating the officer directly implicates this public policy against intentional dishonesty by police officers. And thus our inquiry shifts to whether enforcing the award violates the public policy. And the court goes on to find that because the officer was dishonest, enforcing the award violates public policy. What did the Connecticut court do differently than the courts that follow the majority rule did? It didn't engage in the two-part analysis. It didn't separate the issue of whether there's a public policy against dishonesty from the issue of whether there's a public policy against the reinstatement of a dishonest police officer. And that actually is fairly typical of Connecticut opinions. They focus on the offense, not on the arbitrator's decision with respect to the remedy. So interesting development. I don't know yet, very early, to see whether that will be picked up in other states. Connecticut, as I've mentioned a couple times, has always been sort of an anomaly in these arbitration opinions, and it continues to be with respect to the public policy exception. Our next arbitration case actually isn't an arbitration case at all. Instead, what it is a case that involves a basic arbitration principle. And that principle is called work now, grieve later. It is a principle you see in disciplinary cases involving insubordination. And what the principle says is that if an employer gives an employee a direct order to do something, the employee had better obey that order. And if the employee doesn't like the order, the solution is to file a grievance later, hence the work now, grieve later. It is not to disobey the order. There are a couple of minor exceptions to this rule, work now, grieve later. There's an exception if the order requires the employee to do something illegal or requires the employee to unduly jeopardize the safety of either the employee or coworker or a member of the public. But those exceptions don't come up very often. What's most important is the rule, not the exceptions, the work now, grieve later rule. Well, this is a case, it's a firefighter case. It comes out of the Columbus, Ohio Division of Fire, and a fellow named Wesley Fullen, who's an African-American battalion chief in the division. For 7 years, Fullen served in a variety of leadership capacities in the Fire Prevention Bureau, and in 2004 was assigned to a similar position in what's called the Fire Alarm Office. Also in 2004, a number of investigations started into allegations of criminal and civil misconduct in Fullen's old assignment, the Fire Prevention Bureau. And in the third of these investigations, Fullen was interviewed. A union representative also appeared at the interview, and Fullen objected, saying he wanted to go forward with the interview, he wanted to give an interview, but he didn't want union representation. The investigator insisted that the union representative be present, although the investigator allowed that the representative would be there representing the union and not Fullen. Fullen persisted with his objection. The chief who was conducting the interview twice verbally ordered Fullen to be interviewed with the union representative present. Fullen refused and ended up facing charges for insubordination. The Civil Service Commission eventually reduced a termination decision to a 6-month suspension without pay. Fullen then sued and said he was the victim of race discrimination. And eventually the case makes it up to the federal Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the court dismisses Fullen's lawsuit. And the court starts by accepting Fullen's claims that he was the member of a protected class and that he had suffered an adverse employment action, where the court found that Fullen's argument faltered was that he hadn't shown that the city's asserted reason for his discipline, Fullen's refusal to comply with the direct order, was a pretext for discrimination. And in fact, the court found that the city showed the opposite. It found that the city showed that the division was, in its words, a duty-bound organization wherein following orders has a particular importance. The court admits that while Fullen appeared to have received a particularly harsh punishment for his insubordination, he directly disobeyed the chief even after the chief confronted him and made it clear that Fullen's conduct would amount to insubordination. In other words, what the court is saying, Fullen, what you needed to do is work now, grieve later. Participate in the interview, even though you think that the chief might be giving you an inappropriate order. Participate in that interview and then challenge that through the grievance procedure or whatever complaint form that you particularly choose. Challenge that later. So the court upholds the 6-month suspension for insubordination. While we're talking discipline, let's go down to New Orleans for a little bit, where we have some particularly harsh words from a court towards an employer's disciplinary theory. It's unusual to see a court come down on an employer quite as hard as the Louisiana Court of Appeals did in this case involving the New Orleans Police Department. Very strong comments. Here's what goes on in the case. This arose from an incident that occurred on June 30, 2009. You have a two-person car. Thomas Clark is in the car. He's a 10-year veteran of the New Orleans Police Department. He's working alongside another officer, his partner, Henry Hollins. The two officers observe a female subject standing outside the open door of a van. They think that there's potential drug conduct going on because the subject slams the door of the van and walks away when she sees the officers. And eventually they stop her to talk to her. It's kind of a suspicious person sort of stop. The stop is only two blocks away from the police station, what's called the 6th District Station in New York. And the officers transported the subject to the station for further questioning. What they didn't do was follow department procedures on how you transport somebody. So what they failed to do was to obtain permission from their ranking officer to do the transport. That's a requirement in the New Orleans Police Department. They also failed to notify the dispatcher and get time and mileage figures, or give time and mileage figures to the dispatcher before the transport. So some minor rules violations there associated with the transport. After they get to the station, Hollins tells Clark that basically, let's just kiss this one off. We're not going to process her. This is just minor stuff. And offers to take the subject back to where they found her. Clark says, okay, great. And he leaves. He leaves early. And leaves early without the permission of his supervisor. Hollins then escorts the woman out of the station, doesn't take her back to where he found her, takes her to a remote location where he tries to rape her. Hollins is subsequently arrested, prosecuted, and he's convicted of attempted rape and kidnapping. This case doesn't involve Hollins, it involves Clark, because Clark is fired by the department. And the department takes the position that Clark's failure to follow the two department rules associated with the transport of subjects, getting the permission of the supervisor and getting time and mileage figures to dispatch, that those two rules violations actually resulted in the attempted rape of the subject by Hollins. And this is where we find particularly harsh words from the Louisiana Court of Appeals. The court begins by reciting the city's argument that Clark did not follow protocol in transporting an arrested subject to the police station, which directly led to the act of brutal crimes which could easily have been avoided. In the court's view, and I'm quoting here, this is bunkum. And if embraced by this court, would make both the department and us wrong. Even if Clark had contacted his supervisor before transporting the victim and calling dispatch with the mileage information, Hollins could still have committed the criminal acts he committed. As the court put it, no correlation exists between Clark's violation of protocol and the unfortunate acts that occurred later in the evening. Now, Clark didn't get off completely in this case. The court imposed 5 days suspensions for each of the two rules violations. Clark had earlier admitted that he was owed a suspension for leaving work early, so he got a 20-day suspension for that. So he ended up with a total of 30 days of suspensions, but he did get his job back. And the principle that's at work here is a principle of burden of proof in disciplinary cases. Because what the court is doing is saying really a couple of things, if you think about it, concerning the burden of proof. It's saying employers, first of all, you have a burden, it's your burden to prove your case. It's not the employee's burden of disproving disciplinary charges. It's the employer's affirmative duty to prove that the employee engaged in a disciplinary offense. And secondly, and that's what's so important about this case, the court is saying you have to prove all elements of your case. And in this case, one of the elements of your case was that these two minor rules violations led to the attempted rape. And that, says the court, you can't prove. And thus, it's appropriate to mitigate the punishment. Let's move on from disciplinary cases and talk a little bit about a union's duty of fair representation, because we have a pretty interesting case coming out of New Hampshire in the last couple of weeks that involves the duty of fair representation and a deal that was made between an employer and the labor organization. One thing about duty of fair representation cases to tuck in the back of your heads is that in these cases, the employee is suing both the union and the employer. Sometimes employers think that they don't have anything to do with duty of fair representation cases. That's just a matter between the union and the employee, and that's wrong. What a duty of fair representation case does is to provide the employee the vehicle of challenging the employer's decision. And the vehicle is by claiming that the union breached its duty of fair representation and the employee could not otherwise present the claims against the employer. And so employers can be liable in these cases. They can owe the employee money or whatever the appropriate remedy is. Depending upon the nature of the union's breach of duty of fair representation, the liability may be apportioned between the employer and the union. But these are cases that should interest employers every bit as much as they interest employees. What's this case in New Hampshire all about? It's actually about whether the duty of fair representation is owed to retirees, or kind of sort of about that. So here's what the case involved. There's a fellow who, by the name of Eric Johnson, who was a state trooper and hired on in 1994, and he retired in July of 2007. 3 years before he retired, his union, the New Hampshire Troopers Association, filed an unfair labor practice charge saying that the state had made unlawful deductions from annual leave and sick leave accounts of various troopers. New Hampshire's Public Employment Labor Relations Board upheld the ULP and ordered the state to restore all accumulated annual and sick leave to employees. And thereafter, a long stretch of negotiations ensued between the association and the state over what the remedy was going to look like. And Johnson retired in the middle of those negotiations. Eventually, in 2008, the association and the state reach a settlement agreement, and that settlement agreement gives no compensation to troopers who retired before the effective date of the settlement agreement. Johnson then brings an unfair labor practice complaint against the association, bringing the state in, of course, as a party, claiming that the union breached its, or the association breached its duty of fair representation when it agreed to the settlement agreement by not including any sort of compensation for retired troopers. And the case winds up in the New Hampshire Supreme Court. And the court spends an awful lot of time talking about the issue of whether the duty of fair representation is owed to retirees. And the court ends up pulling its punches on the issue and basically saying, we don't have to decide that. But if you look at the lengthy opinion of the court on the issue, you can tell what the court's thinking. And that is, there really isn't a duty of fair representation to retirees. It just is a duty that is owed to current members of the bargaining unit. But the court puts that issue aside and says, look, even if there is a duty of fair representation that is owed to to retirees, the association didn't breach it. Why not? The court says, look, the standard for a union's conduct that we're going to use to evaluate a union's conduct, and this is a standard, by the way, that applies all over the country, comes to us from Supreme Court decisions, U.S. Supreme Court decisions under the National Labor Relations Act. The standard is whether the union's decision was arbitrary, discriminatory, or in bad faith. What the claim was in this case was that the decision to exclude retirees was either arbitrary or in bad faith. And the court ends up being very sympathetic to the situation a union finds itself in the negotiations process, whether it's negotiations over a ULP finding, as it was in this case, or negotiations in general. And here's what the court had to say about that. Inevitably, differences arise in the manner and degree to which the terms of any negotiated settlement affect individual employees and classes of employees. The mere existence of such differences does not make them invalid. The complete satisfaction of all who are represented hardly is to be expected. And the court goes on to find that, particularly given the uncertain status of whether there was any duty of fair representation to retirees to begin with, the association could make the rational choice not to include retirees in the settlement. The court notes another factor, and that is that the state was dead set against including retirees in any settlement, and that if the association insisted on that, it would have delayed the remedy for everybody by a matter of months and perhaps years, and that was a rational factor for the association to take into account in making the settlement decision. What this case does is to illustrate for us the wide range of discretion that labor organizations have in making negotiations decisions. And if you think about it, what the court had to say is absolutely correct. There are many times where it is inevitable that a portion of a bargaining unit is going to be dissatisfied with the settlement. Every single seniority decision involves a decision that somebody in the bargaining unit is going to be unhappy with. And unions have to be able to make that decision, those decisions, and employers have to be able to negotiate settlements on those decisions with unions without fear of liability for breach of duty of fair representation. Let's shift over now to bargaining for a moment, and let's talk about a kind of a bombshell decision, at least in terms of its importance, that comes to us out of California, and it comes to us from an administrative law judge from California's Public Employment Relations Board, and it comes out of the long-standing contentious issues surrounding the various retirement plans and systems in the city of San Diego. And what this case is about, or this particular San Diego retirement case is about the former mayor of San Diego, a fellow named Jerry Sanders, used to be the police chief of San Diego. And once he became mayor, he embarked on a crusade to cut retirement benefits and eventually a crusade to change the retirement benefits of most employees from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan. Rather than attempt to negotiate those results with the labor unions that were involved, Mayor Sanders instead launched a public relations campaign involving members of the business community. He enlisted some city council members in his efforts, and using the power of the bully pulpit of mayor, and also using some city resources, was instrumental in the effort to place on the ballot a ballot measure that would have changed many San Diego employees to a defined contribution plan, a 401k plan, rather than a defined benefit plan. And the voters in San Diego approved the ballot measure. A group of unions then filed an unfair labor practice charge. And the essence of the unfair labor practice charge was that the city, through its efforts, through the mayor's efforts, really, at getting this ballot measure passed, had effectuated a unilateral change in a mandatory subject of bargaining and had done so without going through the bargaining process. What was the mandatory subject of bargaining? Retirement benefits. The city's answer to this charge was that any public official, including a mayor, could act as a private citizen to draft a ballot measure, to urge citizens to carry it forward, to hold press conferences, to go on TV shows, and do all of the things that Mayor Sanders did. The city also argued that it was the voters who made the change in the mandatory subject of bargaining, retirement benefits. It wasn't the city that made the change. Instead, it was the voters. The administrative law judge sided with the unions and found that the mayor's conduct amounted to an effort to create the unilateral change. And here's the wording of the heart of the ALJ's decision. The ALJ says that the board, in this case California's PIRB, has held that a unilateral change occurs when the employer demonstrates a clear intent to change a policy affecting terms and conditions of employment with no subsequent wavering of that intent, and the employer has taken concrete steps to effectuate the change, even if the action falls short of actual implementation. In other words, simply by deciding to make the change and taking steps to effectuate the change, that is a bargaining event under California law. And parenthetically, I tell you, that's a bargaining event under the laws of most states. Back to the ALJ's opinion. The record establishes that the mayor announced his intention to seek implementation of a new policy regarding pensions. He did so at a November 2010 press conference, at his State of the City speech, and in an April 2011 press conference. The mayor emphasized that his latest proposal was a critical objective of his administration and the focus of his remaining years in office. The ALJ concludes that the mayor's proposal was within matters within the scope of representation, therefore that it is a mandatory subject of bargaining, and goes on to reject the city's claim that the mayor lacked the authority to make policy decisions about ballot measures. In fact, what the ALJ holds is that the policy decision is one to change negotiable subjects, not to seek placement of a policy to that effect on the ballot. By the same reasoning invoked by the mayor, a majority of city council members could propose an initiative measure as private citizens for the express purpose of circumventing the duty to meet and confer. The city, as a public agency, has a duty to refrain from unilateral action undertaken by the mayor, not merely because he's a city official with policymaking discretion, but because he's a statutory agent for purposes of the collective bargaining process. What's the remedy in this case? Rescind the ballot measure and put employees back on a defined benefit plan. Now, of course, this is only an administrative law judge's decision, which means it is a recommended decision. We may have miles to go before we sleep on this, borrowing from Robert Frost, before we see the final decision. I want to wind up this podcast talking about some recent settlements, wage settlements that are out there, and talk a little bit about economic numbers, what the CPI is doing, and give you a preview of some of the issues that are likely to be coming up in our podcast for next month. First of all, let's talk some settlements. Once again, we are continuing to see moderate wage increases and even catch-up wage increases coming into play. 2013 is looking like a much better bargaining year than 2012 for police and fire unions, and 2012 was a better year than 2011. We are still seeing, in conjunction with raises, we're still seeing increased co-payments on, in particular, healthcare and on healthcare and pensions. But we are, instead of seeing wage decreases or furloughs or even wage freezes, we are seeing modest wage increases. And again, if I would have to pick a number, it would be the same one I picked last month. which is that I would expect by the end of the year we'd see wage increases averaging for major public safety agencies in the country, averaging about 1.5 to 2% over the course of the year. The settlements that I'd like to point out to you come from a variety of places across the country. Let's start in Iowa. The Sioux City, Iowa Fire Department settled a 3-year contract, 2013 through 2016. The raises, 1.25% in the first year, 1.75% in the second year, and 2.75% in the third year. This is actually a negotiated agreement that tears up an old contract that had given 2.25% raises in each of the years. So it's a reduction in an agreed upon contract. And it also called for some increased out-of-pocket medical insurance costs on the part of employees. The next settlement is from Wisconsin, where you still have the very uncertain bargaining environment in Wisconsin because of the very uncertain political environment in Wisconsin. This is a contract covering the Racine County Sheriff's Office. It is a 5-year contract. In 2011, the raise, retroactive raise, is 1%, and then no raise in 2012, and 2% raises in 2013, 14, and 15. And the new contract will require deputies and command staff to pay 6.65% towards their pension costs where there'd been no contribution in the past. The city of Orange, California, which is a city in Orange County, California, the fire department there reached a settlement. California continues to struggle a little bit more than the rest of the country does in terms of public sector agencies there and coming out of the recession, and you see that with this settlement. This is a 3-year contract settlement, July 1, 2012 through June 30, 2015. No wage increase over the 3 years in the contract. And it will also see the institution of increased pension contributions for firefighters hired after January 1. The contract, the give on this by the employer is that the contract maintains staffing levels in the department. Then let's move back to the Midwest in Naperville, Illinois, the police department there, where we have a 3-year contract and the first year of the contract, 2012, a 4% raise, no raise in year two, but a 2% raise in year three. And the contract requires employees to start picking up medical care premiums. They'd already been paying a portion of it, but it increases the employee copayment to 20%. And the last settlement that I want to point to you comes from New York, the Sullivan County Sheriff's Office in New York, where they haven't had a contract settlement in ages. This is a contract that is retroactive to 2010 and goes through to 2017. There will be a 9% raise that will be retroactive to that period from 2010 to 2012, and from 2013 on, 1% annual increases. Deputies will contribute $350 more per year to health care coverage, and new deputies will be required to pay 15% of premiums. The old contract had capped premium copayments at 10%. In terms of the cost of living, we're still seeing moderate numbers. In fact, we're seeing numbers that, if anything, are trending lower by a point or two. The CPIW, that's the CPI for wage earners and clerical workers, which is the one that's most often used in collective bargaining negotiations. The latest figures are 1.5%, an annual increase of 1.5%. which is in keeping with the average wage increases that we're seeing out there. The Northeast is a little bit higher at 1.7%, In the Midwest, a little bit lower at 1.2%. In the South and West areas of the country, come in right at the national average of 1.5%. We're still seeing extremely moderate medical cost increases, 3.3% for the annual rate of increase. In terms of our upcoming podcast, I am confident that our next podcast is going to talk about Detroit. Last Friday, the mayor of Michigan placed Detroit in a fiscal receivership and appointed a municipal manager. We have yet to see what it is that municipal manager is going to do. We have seen, however, these financial managers in Michigan come into cities and basically replace city councils and mayors. They will make all decisions with respect to, in the labor relations sense, with respect to grievances. They have claimed to have the ability to tear up collective bargaining agreements, rewrite pension systems. Detroit is a city that is as fiscally troubled as any major city in the country. And by the time we do our next podcast, no doubt the fiscal manager there will have taken his first moves. And quite possibly, we will see challenges to the authority of the governor to appoint a fiscal manager. More next month when we see you again on First Thursday.